see all.
If you lose your hearing, would you perceive your, or would you lose your ability to hear at all?
Oh, no. No, that has nothing to do with it. See, there's an inner ear and an outer ear. The inner ear is the capacity of hearing, and the outer ear is the sense of hearing. This is an interesting thing that people find when they die. Blind people suddenly see perfectly clearly. Deaf people hear perfectly clearly. Your two aspects of senses. The first aspect is the astral body, and the outer aspect is the physical body. But no, you don't lose that ability. Rather, you, by being hard of hearing, it improves your ability. Oh, that was a legal thing. They're still trying to get his body to Mount Washington. I hope they succeed. But legally, they can't have it except here or in some sort of cemetery. It's just a city hall. Yeah. But it would be wonderful if it could be perhaps at Mount Washington, since he founded that first.
Wow.
Yeah. Yes. Okay.
I need this respect for you, but why do you believe in reincarnation, that we come back with a toad or something like that?
He means it respectfully, but why do you believe in reincarnation and that we might come back as a toad or a germ?
I believe in reincarnation because, as far as I can tell, it's a fact. And there has been a great deal of, I wish I had brought my hearing batteries, darn it. Anyway, I'm stuck with it, you're stuck with it. But now I feel as though we're talking in a sort of a strange chamber. Anyway, Ian Stevenson did a lot of research on reincarnation, and it's very interesting, but most of his examples come from the East. Many, many people in America have had their little children tell them that they lived before and so on. And there have been lots of things pursuing this, but one of the most interesting books on the subject is one called Soul Survivor. And there's been a video of it too. It was a little boy who began at the age of 2 or something screaming, having terrible nightmares. And he saw himself going down in flames in a plane. And he recognized planes, he knew all about them, he knew how to fly them, he knew the mechanics, and he remembered having done it in the Second World War, and he remembered some of the... See, his father was a fundamentalist and absolutely didn't believe in reincarnation, although the Bible, in fact, mentions reincarnation more than once. That's a very interesting subject in itself. But he didn't believe in it, and he was doing his best to disprove what his son was claiming. And he ended up going tracing the people who had lived with this boy when he was a pilot of 21 years old. He ended up even contacting his sister, who was by this time 86 years old. And he recognized all these people, and he talked to them, asked them personal questions. One of them, he was old and he couldn't recognize him by looking at him, but he said, "I knew your voice," and he named him. And that was what he was. Anyway, it's a very interesting book. It's called Soul Survivor, S-O-U-L. But this father traced it to every possible doubt that he could possibly imagine and proved to his everybody's satisfaction, I think. One of the things he told to his sister, he called her Annie at the age of 86, a lady of 86 for a child of 6 to be called her Annie. didn't seem appropriate. That's how he knew her. And he asked her about a picture that she, and she showed him a picture, he asked her about another one. And she had that up in her bedroom, but hadn't let anybody see it. But he knew all about it. Many things like that. Anyway, another thing that I have to say about reincarnation is, when I look at people's faces, it's absolutely amazing to see how many different states of consciousness, owing to people's thoughts, habits, tendencies that they brought over from the past. But as I said the other evening, what has been done with two eyes, a nose, and a face that they each one can look different? It's incredible. We have developed these faces over a long time, and we can change those faces too. And as for the toad thing, if you act like a toad, you could come back as a toad. Otherwise, you were not likely to. Yeah, somebody had a question here? Yeah. You.
I'm working with people and being indifferent about going to idol worship.
What's that?
Can you comment about working with the teacher and being in danger of going into deference of idol worship?
Okay.
What's that?
Can you comment on working with the teacher and the difference of being indifference to him or going into idol worship?
Well, idol worship is entirely misunderstood. An image of Krishna is not idol worship any more than Jesus on the cross is an idol worship. It reminds you of a principle. And the image of Krishna is not an idol worship, it's worshiping the divine in a particular form. It's more that you could call it ideal worship. True idol worship means worshiping money, means worshiping things and power and fame and so on. And true idol worship would indeed be worshiping a teacher or having a teacher demanding worship. That would be idol worship because he's taking anything that takes energy away from the infinite God instead of directing energy toward him. It's not good. And so any teacher worthy of the name should not draw you to himself. My guru always said, God is the guru. I am not. He never accepted it for himself. And when we touch his feet, which is the custom in India, he always puts his hands up here, meaning I direct your devotion to God. Jesus Christ said, those who came before me are thieves and robbers. He didn't mean those who came before him in time, because he said, I'm not coming here to destroy the law and the prophets. I'm here to fulfill. But what he meant was those who placed their egos in front of God and trying to draw people's devotion to themselves. Anybody who does that is a thief and a robber, according to the divine principle. And so the teacher above all, but the students also should understand that this person is only a channel to that real one, and that's where the power is coming from. It's a difficult thing because you always have to spend that. It's a very important, for the teacher, it's a very important responsibility. And thank heaven I don't feel that temptation because I know that I'm really nothing anyway. But thank you for asking that question. It's a good one. Yes?
With some more negative aspects of this world, like you know, disease, starvation, this kind of thing, why does
why does God allow the negative aspects of this world, disease?
What is negative? When you have the sun, you have light on one side of an object and dark on the other. So that which is good, Jesus himself said, when somebody said, good man, he said, why do you call me good? There's only one who is good, and that's God. So we can say in that sense that the supreme good comes from that sign. But if you've got a sign, you've got to have the opposite sign. So where you have delusion, where you have creation, there has to be that which is farther away from God and that which is closer to God. And so whatever level you're on, for a lazy prayer, for let's say for a Jesus Christ or a Gandhi or somebody who's spent his life serving humanity, for him to decide one morning when he wakes up, well, I'm tired of serving people, I want to become a millionaire. Even millionaires would say he's fallen. But if a lazy fellow who never does anything gets up and says, I want to become a millionaire, even saints would say this is good. So it depends on where you are, on your own level of revolution. Whatever, wherever you are, that which takes you closer to God is good, and that which would take you further away from God is bad. Everything is relative. People try to make values and moral ethics and so on. Absolutely, they're wrong. You can't do that. There are things that are closer and farther, and depending where you are, a thief who decides to, there's a story Yogananda told about this woman who never did anything for anybody, and finally one day she stole a carrot and bit into it, and it had a worm, so she just gave it to somebody else. When she died, the pages of her good side were completely blank, and the pages of the wrong side were written between the margins and in the lines and everywhere. Finally, she said, I've got to have done something good in this life. Finally, they found a little footnote at the bottom of a blank page saying she had given this wormy carrot to it. And so the angel said, all right, well, you've done something good. Here's a magic carrot. And if you hold on to this carrot, that means whatever good you've done, hang on to that. That will be your raft over the ocean of eternity. So the angel said, if you hang on to that, that will lift you. So this woman was holding the carrot and starting to rise, and she was rising toward heaven. And suddenly she felt a tugging on her feet, and she looked down and she saw all these people hanging on, a long line of people hanging on to their feet, going down. And she said, this is my carrot, get away. And she tried to kick me away. And she lost the hold of a carrot. They all came tumbling down. Yes.
Can you share with us more about the massive order you have in life and why carrying the order?
Can you share more about the monastic order?
No, I can't. I'm working on it. But I am working on it, and I've written 26 pages, and I hope to make somewhat longer, but write to me, and I'll be glad to send it to you.
Thank you. And you mentioned the other evening that you were thinking of Periwinkle Blue.
And you were thinking of Periwinkle Blue.
Yes. Yeah. I think that would be a lovely color. Because, you see, the orange that I'm wearing is traditional, which Master wore and all Swamis wear. It tends to be, God doesn't force himself on people, he invites. Master invited. But orange is more of an aggressive color. And it's very nice for burning up your desires, burning up your attachment, burning up. But it's also, I've found, made many Swamis in India arrogant. And blue is expansive and calming and devotional. So I prefer that color for the spirit of the order that I'm thinking about. Okay? Yes. Yes.
You. When you die from this life, you go to the next life or to the cosmos, I ask, what part of your makeup needs to go with you? You have to take all your flaws.
When you die from this life and you go on to the astral life, what part goes with you? Do you have to take all your flaws too?
Oh, yeah. That part of you that is subtle, that is your consciousness, you take that. Worse than that. If you see, this body is sort of like a thick coating, so that any emotions you have, they're sort of suppressed by this thick walls of flesh. And in that world, whatever joy you have is increased enormously. You no longer have the flesh to hold you in. And if your emotions are negative, they become very powerful too. So the suffering on that side can be much greater too. So I would say, work hard at developing a good side. But don't worry about it, because you're not alone. your desires will bring you back to this world. And as Master used to put it, they don't smoke in heaven. If you've been smoking here and have that habit, you'll have to come here to satisfy. They don't drive cars in heaven. If you'd like a nice Rolls Royce, you'll have to come back here. Because worldly desires cannot be fulfilled here. But pure desires can be fulfilled there. Desires for beautiful music, beautiful scenery, selfless love, these things can be fulfilled there better because they're truer to that. But your whole nature, you don't change at all when you're on the other side. And so much so that many people for a while don't even realize they're dead. Because they aren't dead, they just shed this outer sheath, you see. Any other questions? Yes.
Yes, can you speak about in the 29 Palms retreat any significance that Yogananda chose that area? Because I know about the giant rock or big rock and the integratron.
I think he just chose it because it was a piece of property that was far from things and quiet. He could concentrate. He had to get away from telephone calls and all sorts of interruptions when he was wanting to write. And that's why he chose it. But 29 Palms is a very nice place and very good vibrations. And there's something about desert that has a good vibration. It's as if it were a cleansing period that it's going through. You know, when I was in Egypt back several years ago and I went to the Aswan Dam, I clearly remembered having lived there before in an ashram. And it was all green then. But now it's all desert because this is a purifying time. So he moved there because of the vibrations, because of the solitude, because of the opportunity, all those. But no, as far as I know, at least he didn't give me any great mystical reason beyond that. Yes.
Will the monastic order include women?
Yes, it will. The Swami order doesn't have women because traditionally the Swamis were supposed to walk on the highways and go from place to place, not staying in any place more than 3 days. And it's not convenient for women to do that. Whereas now, if you walked on the highways, you'd be likely to be pulled over by a truck. And so times have changed. But the thought that men and women are different is a great delusion. There's absolutely no difference, except that their difference of the fact women, this is why women have breasts, they have more feeling quality. Men, like I have this Neanderthal ridge here, and this indicates that reason is more uppermost in my nature, but it doesn't mean I don't feel love, and it doesn't mean women can't be intelligent and wise. It just means this is the emphasis of their own character. And at this time, certainly the women would be probably many more women than men because of their devotional nature. They would naturally be more drawn to it. So yes, there would be women swamis. Yeah. Yes, yes.
Is spiritual surrender alone enough to heal past trauma?
Is spiritual surrender alone enough to heal past karma?
No. Simple answer? There are many things we need to do. Part of the reason why Master had me teaching was because he said that my great fault in the past was doubts. I don't have any doubts now, but I need to sort of make that absolutely strong by helping to resolve other people's doubts. So this is my way of expiating that karma. I would be very happy to be a hermit, but I'm also happy to help share these teachings. And that was the part he put uppermost. Whereas with Rajashi, his most advanced disciple, he didn't have him teaching at all. In fact, Rajashi was in charge of a meditation group in Kansas City, and Master said, I didn't want to bother him with that. So it depends on your karma. This is another reason why it's good to have a spiritual guide, because he can tell you those things which will help you spiritually, rather than things that you may be talented at. For example, a person may have great talent as an actor, but that might go to his head and therefore be the worst thing for him. Certain aspects of your nature need to be suppressed, certain other aspects need to be emphasized. So, but action is a very important part of getting rid of karma. If you get a thorn in your flesh, Indians say, take another thorn, you can take that out, then you can throw both thorns away. So action is that other thorn. It helps to offset the negative energy and turn it in a positive way, and then you're free from it. Okay? And yes, yeah. In front.
You should meditate more sleeping rest. And I'm wondering what dreams play through things come to you in dreams. I saw you the other night and had a dream with you and the new master standing beside you.
Okay.
He's saying that you mentioned meditating more and sleeping less, and he wonders what part dreams play. He had a dream the other night and he saw you in the dream with a new master. With Yogananda in a new form, standing next to you.
Dreams, I think, can be helpful. I'll talk more in principle on that one. Many years ago, and this is a story I told also in the New Path, I dreamed that I was a very loyal friend of somebody, but he took advantage of my loyalty and treated me like dirt. And gradually, over several years, I began to feel very bitter toward him that he should so demean the love and loyalty I had given him. And I was approaching death in that lifetime. And I realized that if I died with that bitterness, I would be in a position to hurt him. Then he would be bitter, then he would be born again in a position to hurt me. This, like ripples going back and forth in a pond, it could go on for lifetimes. I thought, why should I waste all that time? I forgive him, it doesn't matter. And in that act of forgiving him, suddenly I woke up and I felt free. So I think I worked out a karma in that dream. It depends on the intensity of the dream, on the clarity of it. One time I had this was not a karmic thing though, but I dreamed that I was flying. And I thought, well, people don't fly. And so I thought, maybe I'm dreaming, you know, as you do sometimes in real life too. And I tried using my dream logic to determine whether I was awake or asleep. And finally, with my dream logic, I reached the conclusion, quite logically, that I was simply awake but doing something strange. And what was my astonishment at the moment later to wake up and find it had been a dream anyway. So we use our logic to tell us that this isn't so, but it seems so, and our logic leads us astray. You can have all the reasoning in the world, but if it isn't so, it isn't so. So that was a very good dream. Another good dream that I had was that I had been born in a torture chamber. And for generations, our family, everybody that I knew, had been tortured, and that's all we knew of life. And life was, we sort of took it for granted, it didn't seem too bad. You woke up, you were tortured, you went to sleep. And there were whole days when you were even tortured less than usual, and they were happy days. But finally, a group of us got together and we thought, there's got to be more to life than just being tortured. So we rose up and we slew these torturers and escaped from the room. And we found we were prepared for other people to meet us, but it was an empty building, and the torture chamber was only on the top floor of the building. See, it's our tortures really are only in our own mind. And we came out of that building onto a vast plain. We hadn't imagined that the world could be so large. And we looked up and we saw these men who had been torturing us, just going about calmly torturing other people. And we hadn't touched them at all. And we looked at each other in amazement. And I said to the person next to me, don't you see, it's ourselves we've conquered, not the torturers. That was a significant dream. I've had several. But as for working out karma, I can only remember that one at the moment anyway, in which I do think I worked out karma. Most of you have to do it on this level. Somebody back there? Yeah, on the seat. No, this one first. No. Go ahead.
This is a question that has perplexed me for many of my years. And it is, if I am who I say I am, and we are who we say we are, is he, therefore, who we say he is?
Sounds like a very intellectual question. First fallacy or number, you say you are.
And we are who we say we are.
And we aren't.
Is he who he says he is, or
is he who we say he is?
Is he who we say he is?
He's not who we think we are, so I guess if we think it, we don't say it right either. How can you know what God is? But those who have known him, they have been able to talk about it from experience. But you're not what you think you are. You're not a man, you're not American, you're not so much as so many years old, and you're not your profession, and you're not any self-definition you can think of. You're none of those things. You are the inner soul, just watching yourself going through all these things. And beyond that, every saint has agreed that he is joy and he is love. And Saint Jean Vianney in France said, if you knew how much God loves you, you would die for joy. And that's a much more important thing to think than all the intellectual questioning you're doing. It won't take you anywhere. I've been through that. I actually approached the whole thing mentally, trying to figure it all out. Thank God I had the good karma to figure out correctly. But when I met Master, I realized it's love alone that gives us what we're looking for. Okay? Yes, back there.
Yeah. Where were you when the Master left his body?
Where were you when Master left the body?
I was in the hall there, listening to him. You came late. I read that whole last part of his life. And I was at the banquet there, and he had me come that evening, and I was taking notes as he was speaking. And, well, I was there. Any yes? Okay.
Could you address habits, especially the habits that draw our consciousness down, and especially when those habits are reinforced by the society we live in?
Can you address habits, especially those that draw us down, and especially when those are reinforced by the society we live in?
Well, let me try to bring it down to this level. Habits are a necessary, as Master put it, a necessary mechanism of the mind to prevent you from taking too much trouble in doing things. For example, tying your shoelaces. When I was 5, they taught me how to tie my shoelaces. It was a very elaborate thing, and I had to go through a lot of effort to tie that one little shoe. But now I do it in talking to other people, I don't think about it. Habit has made that possible. So habit can be a friend as well as a foe. Habit is what helps you to grow spiritually. But here's the interesting thing in that whole subject. In the Mahabharata, which is really an epic allegory of the spiritual path and the search for God, Dronacharya, who was the teacher of both the good side and the bad side, the Kauravas, the Pandavas being the good side, in the battle, sides with the wrong side. And the fact is that in any psychological struggle, it's our habits side more with our bad side than with our good. And what lifts us up spiritually is not so much habit as grace and the superconscious. So don't rely too much on good habits, but try to seek guidance from a higher level. Our habits good, they're part of the mind. We couldn't really function very well without them. But Dr. Lewis said something that I don't yet understand. He said, Master never did anything from habit. I can't put that one together yet, but you might, so think it over. Okay?
I'm going to interject a footnote here. He was talking about Dronacharya from the Bhagavad Gita. Swami has recently done 108 programs that are on YouTube with Master's interpretations of the Gita and speaking on the Gita in various aspects. So search for the Bhagavad Gita on YouTube, and that'll take you, or to go to our website, ananda.org, and you can get to those programs. So wonderful teachings on just these kinds of subjects.
And very concise, because they're only about 10 minutes each. So, yeah, you'll enjoy them. Okay, any other questions? Yes.
What if you're going to advise about increasing Kriya breath, the quantity?
What did Yogananda advise about increasing the quantity of Kriya breaths?
He said it would be a good thing to do regularly. Yeah. Every 6 months, I would say increase 12. But the main thing he also emphasizes is that you do it correctly. So there's no point in just huffing and puffing. You should do it correctly. Yeah.
I remember reading that every 6 months, you should do one technique that you would recommend with the energization exercise.
I didn't know that he said that, but I think it's very interesting that he did. And the energization exercises are what help you to make you aware of your body as energy. And they are a wonderful practice, so that's as much as I can say for that. Somebody back there have a question? Yes.
Yeah, for those of us who haven't had the pleasure of knowing Yogananda in the body, what's your advice on the best way to attune to master?
What's the best way to attune to master?
Master said, concentrate on his image here. Look at a photograph, and especially look at the eyes, and concentrate here, and call to him. The point between the eyebrows is like a broadcasting station, and the receiving set is the heart. So when you feel his answer, it will be in the heart. And so listen here. Okay? Yes.
Can you get to God through communion with the heart?
No, I don't think so. I think it can be helpful, though. I don't want to knock it. But,
what was that question again?
The question is, can you get to God through communion with a partner?
I would say that, as Krishna says in the Gita, those who worship the lower gods go to those gods. If your partner is a saint, communion would be good. If your partner is not, I would say, first of all, in marriage, there should be respect, more than anything else. Because with that, then love comes naturally and properly. But without respect, it doesn't. So, okay, any other questions? Yes, you had one.
Yeah. My question was, I feel long spiritually to receive, and I've been working on trying to see things from above, like the earth, from the master viewpoint, ascended master viewpoint, other to receive answers on what direction we're going to go in, and I'm having trouble with that clarification.
Did you have any?
She's trying to see, draw answers from a higher level, and she's having trouble with the clarification of...
Yeah, I'm trying to get from the viewpoints of the ascended masters looking at the earth, not from here, from like, what I'm saying, but kind of like looking at it objectively also.
It's a question, it's so personal, it depends on you. I myself rather look up than be up. And that then the answer comes. But first there has to be the lack of any prejudice. Don't say, when you want a certain horse to win in a race, let's say, oh, I want to go. You don't want to say, give me this answer, I want this answer. You have to be, whatever you tell me, I accept. I'll do that. You have to have no desire. And when you ask in that way, I would say that was a better way in the beginning to ask rather than to imagine yourself being on that level until you are on that level. Okay? But it's a subtle question, and I'm not sure my answer is the best. Okay? Well, if you're not sure and you feel some guidance, you can't always be sure. But go slightly in this direction. And then if you feel increasing joy, increasing inner freedom, you're going in a good direction. Another thing to remember is that your guidance may be to go to the corner and turn right. Whereas many people, once they've had the director to go on, they go on and on and on to the horizon. And that's not right. So the question should always be there. Am I still doing it what you want? It's something that I have had to do because I was very much challenged by some of my fellow disciples and who thought I was going in a completely wrong direction. And so I had to go very slowly, feeling what Master wanted. And it took me several years to reach the point where I did know that I was doing his will. But be humble. Don't insist you know. Don't insist that your critics are wrong. Just try to be truthful with yourself. And that takes a lot of mental effort. Any other questions? Yes, back there?
Can you please talk to us a little more about divine union between two human beings as an intimate divine union, since it's the building block outside?
Can you talk about divine union between two individuals in an intimate way? Is that correct?
Yes, since that's the building block of...
As a building block or something.
And we go on to the one. Yes?
I set up this morning and I went to why I had to give you this picture. And so I think it's important that I give it to you.
Good idea.
He wants to give you a picture.
And I think what I get.
We can do it afterwards.
I think you can put it now.
I think you should wait a moment. We have everybody here waiting for you to bring it up with us. Between you and me and not you and everybody and me. Any other questions back there?
Could you talk a little bit about the idea of being practical and spiritual? And how to figure that one out?
Can you talk a little about being practical and spiritual?
Being spiritual is the most practical thing of all. I'll tell you this, that many times common sense would have told me not to do something that I have done because I felt it was right. There was one person in the beginning of Ananda, and we needed money very much. I had raised all the money for it myself. And he came and said that, "I would like to ask you a question. Would you think it was better for me to join Ananda or to go to India?" He said, "I have an inheritance, and if I join Ananda, I can give this inheritance to Ananda. But if it's more right for me to go to India, I can use the inheritance to go to India." So I wanted to know if he had enough money to get to India and be there. So for that reason, I asked him, "Well, how much money have you got?" He said, $200,000. That was like $1 million today. Common sense and practicality might have told me, "Well, for heaven's sake, latch on to this guy." I said, "I think you should go to India." And that's, I've always followed that principle, and it's never stood me wrong. I have done that which I felt was right, and it sometimes didn't seem practical. But God took care of it. It's, I think, the most practical thing of all is dharma. In India, they have a saying. I saw it first on the wall of the palace of Kutve, the Maharaja of Kutvehala. Jata dharma tata jaya. Or in Sanskrit, yata dharma tata jaya. Where there is right action, there is victory. Yes?
Swami, can you talk a little and I know it's a very complex question, but the dark night of the soul. And for example, Mother Teresa of India, according to an article that came out in Newsweek some time ago, talked about how the last part of her life, she simply didn't believe in God anymore. And as her life had gone on to where she ended up when she died, she almost lost her faith and she lived in misery. And I know it's a complex question.
Can you speak about the dark night of the soul? And she read an article about Mother Teresa, who for a very long period in the last part of her life, right up to the end of her life, had virtually lost her faith in God.
Yeah, that was a very interesting case. And I met her in Calcutta. She was a short little thing. Did a very big work. I think she got very good karma for it, and I think she's not shouldn't be called a saint in the true sense. The fact that she felt out of tune doing it alarmed me. But at the same time, I do think she got very good karma for helping people. There's something wrong there that she should have such an attitude. And I wouldn't call that the dark night of the soul. What St. John of the Cross went through was the... There is this time when, well, it can be put in different ways. One very interesting way is that when you really overcome your desires, then there's this period of complete blankness. You don't know where to go from here. And then the bliss of Satyadananda, of divine consciousness, comes in. But I suppose people do go through these things, and I suppose in some sense everybody goes through that test. I certainly had to go through it, but I have to say that through it all, my love for Master, there was a time when I wondered even if he had abandoned me, if he had abandoned me. And I said, even if you have, I won't abandon you. And I stuck with him, and I found that, yes, he was always with me. The dark night of the soul is a concept that I have preferred not to think about. I prefer to think of the joy of the soul. The Catholics talk so much about the negative side. I'd rather talk of the joy of seeking God, not the misery of sin and all of that. So forgive me, I can't, even though I've been through it myself, I can't present myself as an expert on that. So. Well, one question more and then we'll have to end it. Yes.
What would you recommend for spiritual discipline, like everyday spiritual discipline, and what is your recommendation?
What would you recommend for everyday spiritual discipline, and what is your daily practice?
My daily practice is meditation, practice of Kriya Yoga, and the different techniques that Yogananda taught us. But more than that, I try to share every thought and every feeling with God. So that when I'm eating, I feel I'm eating with God. When I'm talking, I feel that I'm talking also with Him. And I try to feel that He's behind you when I'm talking to you. And I feel that He's... everything I do, I try to share every thought with Him. I try to speak to Him in the second person. Call Him you, not he or she. And that's my practice. Well, everybody, I need to leave, but thank you for coming.